Al Jazeera Podcasts.
The US House of Representatives agrees a $61 billion aid package to Ukraine after months of political wrangling. More than a third will go on weapons to battle Russian forces. Will this help end the war, or will it just prolong the fighting? I'm Tom McRae, and you're listening to the Inside Story podcast, where we dissect, analyse and help define major global stories. Let's bring in our panel now. In New York, Chris Hedges is a former Middle East bureau chief of the New York Times and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. In Washington, D.C., Anatole Levin is the director of the Eurasia Program at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, a U.S. think tank. And in Bath, in the U.K., Patrick Bury is a defence and security analyst, as well as a former British Army officer who's also worked alongside NATO. Thank you very much for being with us here on Inside Story. Patrick, if I can begin with you, and before we get to the longer-term implications of this aid package, Ukraine has waited months and months for this to be signed off. How desperately needed is it, and what impact is it actually going to have on the war?
Hi, Tom. It's critical. And I think the mood music in the States reflected that this bill was going to get through because of the nature of the threat that Ukraine is facing. Essentially, it's quite a defensive, the way it looks is going to be quite a defensive package. And the number one priority at the moment is air defence. And Ukraine has obviously had some Patriot and Astra systems from the US and Europe, but it needs more. It has somewhere in the region of 3 to 5, and it's asked for another 7 more. The good news is it can get that quite quickly. I'd say most of the nations that provide these systems can move them fairly quickly. The US will have stockpiles of certain kit in Europe already, and I'd say that is the number one priority. The second thing then is large caliber artillery shells. They need them quickly too. Might take a little bit longer. There's numerous different efforts going in Europe and obviously the US to get those to them. I don't think at the moment that will be quite enough, but at least it gets the ball rolling.
Chris, Volodymyr Zelensky has said in response to this that Ukraine will now have a chance for victory. Is $61 billion enough, though, for Ukraine to actually finish this war? Or is it simply going to prolong this current stalemate that we've seen over recent months?
No, it will prolong it. I think since Ukraine's failed counteroffensive in 2023, they, by their own admission, or they call it active defense, the Russians have made territorial gains. But there was always an understanding from the inception of this war that Ukraine could not win a war of attrition. It's now, I think the average age of its troops is something like 43. It's having very extreme difficulties recruiting. I think the fear and the reason that this was pushed through is the possibility of Ukrainian collapse. But the intent of Washington was never to essentially allow the Ukrainian forces to defeat the Russians, but it was to create a proxy war whereby the Russian military would be degraded, Vladimir Putin would be isolated, and then the third aspect of that was to degrade and cripple the Russian economy. That did not happen, apparently. But that's what proxy wars are about. I covered the Kurds in northern Iraq. They never wanted U.S. never wanted a Kurdish state. They just wanted to harass the Iraqi regime. And so they are prolonging a proxy war that will end in negotiations. Sadly, negotiations that could have been done before this war began.
Yeah, we'll get on to the negotiations and when they may begin and how they would play out in just a moment. But Anatole, we also heard from Zelensky saying that this US aid package sends a strong signal that Ukraine will not be a second Afghanistan, that the United States will stay with Ukraine, and that it also sends a powerful message to Putin and the Kremlin. Do you agree with those statements? And do you agree with Chris as well that this package is just going to prolong this proxy war that the US is fighting with Russia?
Well, this package will help Ukraine to stand on the defensive. There's no question of that. And as Mr. Bury has said, this is, you know, basically a defensive package. But it will not help Ukraine, or will help, but it won't ensure that Ukraine can break through the Russian lines and win in its turn, which of course it failed completely to do last year, and those lines are being strengthened all the time. Now, Zelensky continues to define peace in terms of total Ukrainian victory. The Ukrainian peace package says that Russia must withdraw from all the territory it's occupied, including Crimea, and war crimes, trials, and reparations. That requires complete Ukrainian victory, which we're not going to get. Secondly, of course, U.S. support for Ukraine is now ensured by this package for this year. But we have elections in America in November. And of course, if Trump is elected, what happens next year is completely unsure. So in the longer term, given the huge imbalance of population and resources between Russia and Ukraine, yes, I mean, it will be a war of attrition, and the odds are still on Russia's side.
Mm. Patrick, just picking up from that point and what you said earlier about this being a defensive package, I mean, Biden has warned numerous times that without massive US military aid and support, the Ukrainian resistance would pretty much completely collapse. What happens if the money doesn't keep flowing, especially after the election, the US election at the end of this year?
Well, essentially, Tom, the wind in Ukraine's sails would slowly die, and then it would eventually come under such pressure from the Russians that they would have to start conceding territory. And then it would be down to the manner of which that and how much the Russians took, and also whether the Ukrainians had to switch to some sort of insurgency. To go back to Charles' point, you know, I don't think the West actually had a plan for this being a proxy war. I think if you look at the nature of the way that the Ukrainians defended at the start of the war, they exceeded expectations much higher than what people thought. And originally, all the weapon systems that went in suggested they were going to be, the West were going to be funding an insurgency, especially in the west of the country, rather than a full-scale toe-to-toe conventional fight, which it turns into. So Ukraine exceeded expectations, and the policy decisions had to evolve with that. We are where we are now. I don't think the Ukrainians would have also accepted a negotiated settlement before the war. There's some obviously major differences about whether internally they want to accept anything now. So, but we are where we are. I think the point is, the defensive form of warfare is in the ascendancy. It's even hard for the Russians, even though they're getting into a groove and making some advances, it's harder for them to mass in secret and then break through like we've seen in previous wars. And because of that, the advantage is with Ukraine generally, as long as they can keep their sensors and intelligence picture going. Their big question is, do we take a year and go on the defensive and then with some massive amount of US and Western support, train up and do a bigger offensive in 2024? I actually think that's probably becoming less likely as time passes. In part as a result of this delay to the package, if it had come back in October when it was needed, then we would have been into a phase in spring of planning and prepping for the year, holding off the Russians for a year and going again for an operational victory. Not a strategic victory, but another operational victory next summer. I think we've lost so much time now, I'm not sure that's going to happen.
Chris, it seems like we're already talking about next summer, let alone in the one in the coming months. What do you make of where this is going to go? Do you think it is just going to continue, I guess, rolling along month after month with very little movement in terms of territory gains or losses on either side?
Well, I just want to address that issue of momentum, because that is true, that at the inception of the conflict, and this was a lot of this was due to failure within the Russian military on their intelligence, their tactics. They didn't have the logistics. They didn't have the troop numbers. And the Ukrainians, especially in that initial rush of enthusiasm and the flood of Western weapons, were able to make military gains. But all of that has been neutralized. The tactics, especially the strong defensive tactics, have changed. The Russian forces have more than doubled in size. And then, of course, the Ukrainians, as I mentioned before, are having great difficulty mobilizing and increasingly older troops that are not particularly well trained or motivated. The Russians have got more effective tactics in terms of defending attacks, and they've increased their capacity to jam the electronic systems which these NATO weapons use. So the war has changed dramatically from that initial inception. I'm not sure I would use the word stalemate, because it is a war of attrition. Stalemate is essentially something that doesn't change. A war of attrition on the ground, it may not change in terms of the actual territorial occupation. But that steady attrition on the Ukraine just can't afford it. And at that point, at a certain point, you go back to World War One or something, you see those forces that are being chipped away essentially collapse. And I think that's a real possibility in Ukraine eventually.
Anatole, I can see you nodding along there. What do you make of that? I guess that's how you see it too.
Yes, I think Chris is exactly right. And of course, absolutely critical here is the issue of troops, of numbers of troops, because even if we go on giving Ukraine massive amounts of weapons, we cannot generate the troops to use those weapons. And Ukraine is more and more outnumbered, and its troops on the ground are exhausted. So, yes, I mean, the longer the war goes on, the greater the risk that, as Chris said, as in the First World War, you have a war of attrition, but which eventually does end with the collapse of one side. And that side, I think, we must assume would be Ukraine and not Russia.
I believe that roughly 30,000 Ukrainian soldiers have been killed so far in 2 years of war. Anatole, I know that you have been to Ukraine since the war began. Can you just give us a little bit of a view of what the people, the population make of this war of attrition, as we're calling it here today? I mean, we often hear from the government's point of view, obviously, but we really, very rarely hear from the people inside Ukraine. Are they at a turning point here where they want to see an end to the war at this point?
Well, I mean, as one would expect, I mean, there are great divisions of opinion under the surface in the Ukrainian population. By the way, I mean, the estimate of the statement by Zelensky of 31,000 Ukrainian dead is taken by most military experts to be a huge understatement. Probably the 50,000 BBC figure for Russian dead is also a great understatement. But one has seen, I mean, already when I was there last year, everybody I talked to wanted the Ukrainian offensive to succeed. But a large minority said that if it didn't, then rather than, you know, fighting on and losing more and more dead with no realistic hope of victory, that Ukraine would have to negotiate and concede at least a considerable amount of the territory that it has already lost. Now, a majority then said no, Ukraine must never surrender territory. But it was also striking that the people who said that in the end we will have to compromise, it was a large minority, as I say, but not one of them was willing to say it on the record. So one has to be wary of, including of opinion polls, which say that, you know, Ukrainian people are united in opposing any kind of compromise peace. And more recent opinion polls have suggested that there has been a strong shift towards belief that there must be a compromise peace, not yet a majority, but an even larger minority. Now, of course, one must say that that does not mean that these people support Ukraine simply surrendering to Russia and Ukraine becoming, you know, a Russian client state. There is overwhelming opposition to that. The question is basically whether you negotiate a peace which involves Russia holding what it now has, and which also, of course, involves the Ukrainian Treaty of Neutrality. What has also been noticed, of course, by many Ukrainians is the fact that while the West has given massive aid to Ukraine, of course, the West has not gone to war to defend Ukraine, which, as Zelensky himself said in the first month of the war, does raise the question of what NATO membership is for, or whether, in fact, Ukraine ever will be a member of NATO, and therefore why, in fact, Ukraine should not sign a treaty of neutrality if accompanied by some forms of guarantee for its future security.
But before we move on to potential negotiations in all of this, Patrick, I want to come to you just in regards to the Ukrainian soldiers. Obviously, as we heard, a minimum 30,000 have died already, up to potentially 50,000. The longer that this goes on, is this the greatest risk to Ukraine, the lack of troops that they have coming in behind those on the front line that continue to be killed?
That depends, doesn't it? You know, it depends on the rate of loss relative to the Russians and their ability to replenish it. But look, it's got, like, you're talking long term in the way that Germany was eventually strangled in the First World War, which Chris was talking about. There's some truth in that analogy. A smaller nation with a smaller population and an economy can't go against, you know, a former global superpower with, you know, 200 million odd people. It just doesn't happen. And a lot of people have left Ukraine too. So that's the longer term picture, and I agree. But, you know, and there's worrying indicators. You know, Russia's adding about, or at least replacing, adding to its forces 30,000 people a month. The Ukrainians stalled over their mobilization over the winter, basically, and are only just getting around to it now. That should have happened much faster, you know. But I do think that the, you know, we're going to talk about negotiations. That's ultimately, and I think Anatol is talking about that, it's down to the Ukrainians to decide when enough is enough, if enough is enough, and that's for them to decide. All we've done really is give them the stuff, and some of it's too late to keep fighting. So, I mean, we've also gone, oh, I can see Anatol, you know, shaking his head. We've gone over and told them to keep fighting at times. We'd give them support and we'd stand by them. And I suppose some of the Ukrainians are coming out now saying, well, we thought there'd be more. But on the NATO point, you know, Ukraine isn't in NATO. It wasn't even a core ally like Israel is. No. And you know, so I think that's probably not being made clear enough to them in the past, potentially.
Yeah. Anatol, I'm going to come to you shortly if now is the time to negotiate. But Chris, I want to bring you back in here, because do you think that this really is, after $61 billion of aid is soon to be heading towards Ukraine, is this the time to negotiate? And if not, when?
Well, I think the longer Ukraine delays negotiations, the weaker its position becomes. And there is going to have to be an exchange of land for peace. I think that's inevitable in eastern Ukraine, which Russia regards as Russian historically and culturally, with some justification. So I don't think time is on the side of the Ukrainians.
Mm. Anatol, I want to bring you back in here. Obviously, we saw you shaking your head before in regards to this. Do you think that there has to be an exchange of land for peace? And do you think that the Ukrainians will accept that?
Well, I think, first of all, we obviously have a role in this. If we are giving so much help to Ukraine and, you know, endangering our own security in the process, of course we have a say in a peace settlement and negotiations. I mean, I think the American people, European publics have every right to demand that. But I think it's very important to say two things. One is, there are things that the West, or really only, in fact, America, can and should negotiate. And one of those things is NATO membership, because after all, NATO membership is not up to Ukraine, it's up to us. Mm. It's up to the existing members of NATO. We can negotiate, as we did with the Soviets over Austria in the early 1950s. We can negotiate a treaty of neutrality without NATO membership and force mutual force limitations. That's not up to the Ukrainians. Now, when it comes to saying that only the Ukrainians can negotiate peace, I think the problem is also that if you look at the political situation in Kyiv, if you look at the pressures on President Zelensky, they can't actually do that. It's not politically possible for them to initiate negotiations. We will have to do that. The final point is on territorial concessions. Look, the territories in the east at the moment are lost. If Ukraine cannot reconquer them on the battlefield, it won't get them back at the negotiating table. But that does not mean that the Ukrainians should or could, or that we should or could tell them formally to give up those territories, to negotiate them away, because they can't do that. And in any case, that would be completely contrary to international law. But Russians have suggested that actually, and by the way, this was part of the peace plan in March of 22, that rather than agreeing on the status of those territories, negotiations on them should be deferred for future discussion, mm-hmm. which, after all, is what we have done at the international community in the case of Kashmir, in the case of Cyprus. So you don't try to solve the territorial issue, you freeze it for future negotiations, which, in the case of Cyprus and Kashmir, would probably go on for generations.
Petrick, is that viable? Is that a viable option here, do you think?
Well, it comes down to the intent of Vladimir Putin and whether you can trust them and whether a frozen conflict is indeed going to be frozen or if they're going to keep taking pot shots across it. Because I would, if I was him, to stop them getting anywhere near NATO, wouldn't you? And as I said, intent and trust, of which both, I think, intent very, very difficult to understand and trust very, very low. But I totally agree with Anatol. Yeah, listen, you know, what I was getting at was the Ukrainians will have to decide whether they've had enough to fight. And of course, we have some skin in the game. We've got a lot of skin in the game. And that gives us, and I'm sure it's going on, you know, good counsel being given to the leadership. But ultimately, it's for them to decide. And I do think Zelensky, you know, the maximalist goal, while rhetorically useful, etc., especially in the early days, you know, really, let's be realistic, militarily, even with a massive longer-term support from NATO allies, including the US, you know, you're looking at a larger version of what failed last summer. You know, a larger, better-prepped version of that. That's about the best. And that would just take back another chunk of land. You know, so maybe the southern coast around from Mariupol around to the outskirts and further south of Zaporizhia, for example. And of course, that would put Crimea under, you know, much more direct threat. But we're still talking operational rather than strategic victory, you know, and you need to string together a number of operations to get it into strategic victory. So, yeah, I think militarily, it's because of this delay, it's become a more difficult thing to take back any ground.
Yeah. Chris, I just want to finish up with you and take a bit of a step back. Does anyone actually want, whether it's the US, Ukraine, Russia, EU, NATO, does anyone actually want this to come to a quick conclusion, or are all of those parties prepared to just grind this out as long as it takes?
I don't think they're prepared to grind it out. Well, that is, by the way, their strategy, as long as it takes, whatever that means. I don't think there is any hard sense or understanding of where we are going with this. I'm talking about the United States. They haven't asked those hard questions. What does as long as it takes means? Well, you know, strategic. But the support is wavering. I mean, we see it in the United States. With a Trump presidency, it's very possible that there could be a severe reduction in terms of support for Ukraine. So, no, I think that there is a diminishing appetite for a forever war in Ukraine, especially since there has not been clear-cut and definitive goals set, in particular by Washington.
Mm. We'll have to leave it there, but we really do appreciate your time. And I guess, first and foremost, we'll have to see exactly what difference the $61 billion is actually going to make on the battlefield. Chris, Anatol and Patrick, we really do appreciate your time. Thank you. This episode was produced by Dermot Fleming, Imogen Kimber, Veronica Pedrosa and Gemma Harries. Studio sound was by Aston Goodison. The program was edited by Mohamed Sobi, Zainab Bada and Joe DeFrias. Be sure to subscribe to the Inside Story podcast to catch each and every episode. Thank you very much for listening. Tune in on Monday for our next edition.
This week on The Take, what would a third term for Prime Minister Narendra Modi mean for India? That's The Take by Al Jazeera. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.